Houston Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Hello, Jim.
And hello there, Marjorie Egan. And the last time Congressman Seth Moulton called in from the Hill, let me see, people were still talking about American Sniper. Netanyahu was polarizing Congress, and we're still reeling from the polar vortex. We could barely hear the congressman through the snowpack that encased our Brighton studio. Today, we're blinded by sunlight. Deflated footballs are public enemy number one. And Congressman Moulton has been unanimously elected the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Health and Technology on the House Small Business Committee. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much for being with us, Congressman. Well, I've got to say, I'll start with praising you, Congressman. You're getting a lot of, as we say, puff pieces in the business. In other words, good press for your early days in Congress. And one of the pieces talks about your breaking with your party over the vote on this Air Force A-10 Thunderbolt II, which you apparently view as an obsolete Cold War kind of airplane. Please tell us about that vote and why you voted the way you did.
Well, I proposed an amendment to partially retire the A-10. The Air Force wants to retire it entirely, but shift some of that funding that the Air Force hasn't even asked for into things that our frontline troops need, like IED protection. There are a number of unfunded requirements in the defense budget, and yet a lot of politicians on Capitol Hill want to put money into an aircraft that the Air Force said it doesn't even need.
And doesn't this aircraft have something to do with your district, Congressman?
Well, actually, it has to do with some districts in Arizona, most of all, which is why it's become a political football. Most A-10s are based in one of the most contentious districts in the House. But for me, as just evidence that I'm not doing this for political reasons, but really just thinking about what the frontline troops need, it turns out that the engines for the A-10 are built in my district. So I'm taking a serious political risk here and trying to do the right thing for our national security and for the troops that we asked to defend it.
How hard is that? When you have to go back home, you've been doing this job 3 months. Obviously, you've spent a lot of your life in pretty tough situations overseas. How hard is it to go back home and tell people who, I'm guessing, a significant percentage of whom supported you, by the way, I just can't support this thing that supports jobs for a decent number of you. How do you do that? How hard is that?
I mean, look, it's hard because people want jobs and need jobs, and I'm doing an awful lot to bring jobs to this. I mean, economic development is my number one priority. But I think people know where I stand with the truth and where I stand with our national security, and people can understand that argument. And frankly, look, it's hard, but it's not nearly as hard as going to Iraq.
I bet that's not. You know, I'm sorry, Margaret.
I just want to say what this looks like to me, it looked another way, is what people really want. I mean, the impetus to hold on to this Thunderbolt airplane has more to do with money and jobs than it has to do with needs. And you see the needs as different, having been overseas.
Well, the reality is we live in a tough environment where we don't have all the money that we would like. In a perfect world with unlimited budgets, we would keep the A-10 in the inventory. It's conceivable in a hypothetical scenario that the troops might someday be in a place where only the A-10 could come to their support. But that's exceedingly unlikely. There are plenty of other planes that can do the mission. But we know for a fact that thousands, literally thousands of troops have died from IEDs. And so when the military asks for funding for IED protection, we ought to provide it.
We're talking to Congressman Seth Moulton from the North Shore. He's in his first term. Congressman, I hope I get this right, and if not, when you correct me, be kind. My understanding is the vote that happened on the renewal of certain portions, expiring portions of the Patriot Act, you voted, the delegation here was split, both to put restrictions on the so-called bulk data collection that the NSA was doing, but at the same time, you did vote with the majority to renew those expiring sections of the Patriot Act. Is that am I right so far?
Yes, that's right. I mean, look, this is another tough vote because I've thought long and hard about the balance between security and privacy, and I was opposed to the bulk data collection and had a lot of problems with it and with the Patriot Act as originally passed. But I think this new bill really strikes a pretty good compromise between the concerns on both sides. We've got to provide for our national security. And frankly, a big part of the reason why we haven't had another major attack since September 11th is because of the government doing a good job protecting our security, and we've got to make sure that they're still empowered to do so. At the same time, we've got to protect the basic rights enshrined in the Constitution and a fundamental expectation of privacy among the American people.
You know, you were kind enough to join me on Greater Boston the other night with your colleague, Joe Kennedy, another congressman. And I know you in a, which is rare for congressmen, admit you don't have the answers to all questions, and you do look to people of expertise. Some pretty respected members of the delegation disagree with you. Capuano, Clark, McGovern, Neal, all were concerned that the Patriot Act, as renewed, as per your vote, didn't give enough privacy protections to people, I guess based upon history. Where are they wrong, Congressman?
Well, look, I mean, they're very thoughtful on this issue as well. And like I say, it's a tough vote. You know, we're trying to strike the right balance here, and it's a difficult issue. I think one of the concerns is that if we don't pass this version of the bill and another attack does happen, then the backlash could be really severe. And we could end up with far greater infringement on people's privacy if that scenario were to play out. So I think it's the right thing to do. And I'll tell you, one of the people I talked to was Congressman Ruppersberger from Maryland, who's been on the Intelligence Committee for years. And he has spent a lot of time understanding in depth, including at a classified level, exactly what the NSA does, where they may be going over the line and where they're not. So I sat down and talked with him about this bill before taking the vote.
We're talking to Congressman Seth Moulton. Congressman, Marjorie and I both brought up your name after we read Seymour Hersh's piece the other day. And for people who haven't seen this, it was in London Review of Books. And Hersh, with all anonymous sources, but this guy's a Pulitzer Prize winner, obviously broke huge stories in Abu Ghraib and other places. He contends that the United States story on the capture of bin Laden is cooked from A to Z. He does acknowledge that bin Laden's dead, but to summarize quickly, he contends we didn't just find out and then assault his compound, but in fact, Pakistani intelligence had him basically locked up in Abbottabad for years. Two, it wasn't that courier we traced, but rather a Pakistani intelligence official who wanted part of that $25 million reward. Three, he wasn't buried at sea. You know, that's significant. And four, that there wasn't a firefight. Again, the only agreement seems to be that he's dead. If Hersh, first of all, do you believe Hersh's account? And two, if Hersh is right, should the American people be concerned, or is the only thing that matters the bottom line here?
Well, I have to say, I haven't read Hersh's account, and I've never heard anything like this myself. So I'm doubtful, but I'd want to read his piece and understand his position before making a judgment. But absolutely, I think it matters whether or not the American people are being told the truth here. And, you know, this goes back, Marjorie, to a point you made earlier, which is that we have to make tough decisions here in Washington. And I think the people know that they elect leaders to make tough decisions. But they elect leaders to be honest. And we ought to be honest about those tough decisions and explain ourselves. And I think that applies to issues regarding our national security as well.
Well, yeah, this is a very distressing piece of journalism by Seymour Hersh for those of us who saw the movie and read all the stories and all that kind of stuff. So he's a great journalist. I hope he's not the best journalist on this one. But anyway, we have obviously, as you know, Seth Moulton, we have a trial going on here in Boston, the Tsarnaev trial, the Marathon bombing trial. The jury now has the decision whether to sentence Tsarnaev to death or whether to sentence him to life in prison without parole, likely ending up in a supermax prison in Colorado. I know you've spoken out before about the death penalty, but tell us what you think the jury would be the just verdict in this case of Zhohar Tsarnaev.
Look, I'm morally opposed to the death penalty, and you can't be morally opposed to something like that and then make exceptions even for such a terrible, awful situation is this. I mean, Tsarnaev, I don't think there's any question that he's a brutal murderer, the worst criminal that there is. But I have a moral position on the death penalty, and I'm going to uphold that. And that's what I hope the jury decides as well.
You know, Congressman Moulton, I know you were on Jim's show because, of course, I watch it every night and I tape it if I happen to be out. So I know you were on with Congressman Kennedy and you talked about one of the things that Jim and I are obsessed with, cameras in the courtroom. I just want to give you a backdrop. Yesterday I had the chance to actually go to the courtroom and see the closing arguments. But this is what I had to go through to get into that courtroom. I not only had to get a specialized pass from the federal government to allow me to get into that courtroom. I had to get one of my colleagues, Emily Rooney, to graciously give me upper seat because the seats are basically taken by everybody to allow me to go in for that brief period of time. The courtroom is filled with people who work for the U.S. Attorney's Office. There are certain places for victims and there are certain places for media. Other than that, you cannot see Zohar Tsarnaev. You cannot see the jury. You cannot see the judge. You can't hear anybody. The public is essentially barred, even though there are overflow rooms to go to the courtroom. And when those overflow rooms, you can't see 95% of what goes on in the courtroom. You can just see what one camera focuses on. To me, the public in the United States of America is essentially barred from every single solitary federal trial that goes on, including in this case, the victims of the Marathon bombing who might have wanted to go and see this trial but were effectively barred because the parking on a mundane level is so bad. So that's obviously, you know where I stand on this, Congressman Moulton. I don't get why you would be opposed to cameras in the courtroom allowing the public to see the trial going on in their name.
Well, look, Marjorie, you present a compelling argument. There's no question that it seems like this would be helpful in this case. And as I've said before in our little interview here, that I'm a big proponent of government transparency, even when it comes to issues of national security and certainly when it comes to issues of basic justice. But this is an area where I'm frankly not an expert, and so I've talked to people who are prosecutors or have been prosecutors and lawyers and whatnot, and their concern is that there are plenty of federal trials where allowing cameras in the courtroom could put witnesses at serious risk. Witnesses who have the courage to come out and testify against mobsters, or children who have to testify against child molesters. And so it seems to me like there are some very legitimate concerns, and that's why the law is written the way it is. I'm not opposed to a discussion about whether there should be exceptions, and maybe that's where this debate should go, is how do you craft a policy where you could have exceptions for cases like the Marathon bombing trial, where it seems like the public interest is clearly with more transparency.
What if it was the opposite, Seth Moulton? What if the presumption was, just like every state courtroom in America, they were open to cameras and microphones, but the discretion lay with the judge in certain circumstances, like that kid. And by the way, I'm assuming in most state trials,
they don't
allow a kid to be on television or testifying against the mobsters, same deal.
And they don't show the jury either.
Right. The judge has the discretion to essentially limit coverage during a trial. In other words, the default position would be it's open, subject to the judge closing a piece of that. Is that something you'd at least be open to?
Well, it's something I would certainly consider, but this is an example of an issue where I'm not an expert. I want to hear both sides of the debate and, you know, not base my decision on the position of one interest group or another, but really on the facts. And so I'd want to learn the facts and talk to people who have been in these situations before, have had to prosecute very difficult cases, or frankly had tough defendants to stand up for. So I think, you know, it's clearly a place where we need to have some debate, but I'm not prepared to make a decision one way or the other until I better understand the facts.
Okay, so when you see Marjorie picketing outside your house, Seth Moulton, you'll understand why she's there. You know,
right.
Seth, Congressman Moulton, I wasn't aware, I'm embarrassed to say, till our colleague told me about your elevation to be the ranking member. Ranking member in English for people means when the other party has a majority, he's the ranking Democratic member. This subcommittee on health and technology, a small business committee, that's not insignificant for a freshman. What are the two or three primary things you care about that fall under the umbrella of that you hope to move on?
Well, actually, it's a great fit for the 6th District because technology and healthcare are two of the industries that are very important to the district, but also two industries that we hope to have a lot of growth in for the 6th. One of the things I've talked a lot about, for example, is really helping to turn around the city of Lynn. And the city of Lynn is the gateway to the 6th. It's just north of Boston. It has tremendous potential. I mean, it's a 15-minute train ride from downtown, and yet it has vacant land along the waterfront, acres of disused industrial space. And what we'd like to do is try to get some of the startups that are growing out of the universities in Boston and Cambridge and try to, as they expand and grow, have them move up to places like Lynn rather than out west or out of state or even overseas. So I think that, being in the, as a ranking member on this subcommittee, which on the Small Business Committee, so we're really talking about small business here. We're not talking about major healthcare conglomerates or the Affordable Care Act. We're talking about what we can do to spur innovation and growth in small businesses that deal with health and technology. And look, it's something that we need to do a better job of for the entire country, but I think it'll be especially beneficial to the 6th District.
You know, you're, as I've said now about 14 times, you're only a few months into the job. You're historically, people know, four tours of duty overseas. Is the snail's pace with which most things move and the lack of power, at least on most issues, that the members of the minority party like you have had, is that driving you nuts, or how are you adjusting to the reality of being in the minority party and being a freshman, even though you got some assignments, including the Armed Services Committee, which are huge for a freshman? How are you adjusting to that reality that, sit back and wait?
Well, it's frustrating. And, I mean, everybody's frustrated with the pace of things in Washington, and it's hard to be here in the institution and just see so many people not willing to make the tough decisions to move the country forward. The political risk is sometimes the number one calculation in people's minds rather than just focusing on doing what's right. But I've been in frustrating and difficult places before. I mean, the U.S. Congress is frustrating, but it's not as frustrating as Iraq often was. And I think what you have to do is you have to pick your battles. You have to find places where you can make an impact and make a difference. And that's what my team and I have been doing. We have an incredibly talented team. In fact, we got about 1,000 applications for the 18 spots in our office.
So that's great.
We have the best people working for us, and we're working very, very hard. So even in the midst of an institution that is frustrating and is often dysfunctional, we have a team that hit the ground running, and we're going to work hard every single day to serve the people of the district I represent.
You know, you are one of 20% of the Congress, give or take a percent, who obviously has served in the military. Is that subset of Congress less partisan and less at each other's throats? Meaning, are you better able to work with fellow veterans who are Republicans than the average Democrat can with the average Republican because of the shared experience you have?
I think that's true, and it's at least a starting place. I've made a serious, sincere effort to reach out to Republicans. I had a lot of Republicans cross the aisle to vote for me, and my message throughout the campaign was that we need to work together, not compromise our principles, but find places where we have common ground. And a good example of this is the op-ed that I co-authored with Representative Steve Russell of Oklahoma about what to do with ISIS in Iraq. And, Representative Russell is a very conservative member of Congress. There are not a lot of issues that we see eye to eye on. But we were able to find common ground on what to do with Iraq. And I think it was a powerful statement that that two people from very different places on the political spectrum, representing very different constituencies, could agree on what to do on this important issue. I mean, I think it was more powerful to co-author that op-ed with Representative Russell of Oklahoma than, say, one of my colleagues from Massachusetts. And the reason why we found common ground is because I just invited him out to dinner one night. And I said, let's find some places where we might agree. I think he thought it was a little awkward when we went to a restaurant on Capitol Hill.
You were seen together.
Well, we were seen together. I mean, he sat down. He was kind of looking behind him like,
That's right.
I said, look, man, we're not on a date. I'm just trying to get to know you. And it was a great conversation. And you know what? We spent some time together since then. And recently he brought up that he is a big proponent of comprehensive immigration reform, and he asked me if I'd like to work on that.
Wow.
Now, if I had gone to my staff and said, find me a Republican to work on immigration reform, I guarantee you he would have been near the bottom of the list. I mean, he just doesn't align with his political profile. But it turns out that he really cares about this issue. And, you know, there's the potential for a powerful alliance. But I never would have known that at a professional level if I just didn't get to know him personally. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, Congressman, share with our listeners the common ground you found together at your dinner where you had to look over his shoulder. What and the piece you guys wrote together. What should we be doing about ISIS in Iraq?
Well, first of all, we really need a strategy. And I fear, and Representative Russell agrees with me, that we just don't have a long-term strategy. I mean, we have some short-term military plan to drop some bombs and, you know, advise the Iraqi military. But the worst mistake we could make is to send American troops into combat in Iraq again, even if they're just advisors, which is really a combat role, and then not have a long-term political and diplomatic plan to ensure the stability of the country, because we might then find ourselves back there again 4 or 5 years after we leave, just as we are doing so today. So what I'm saying is that let's come up with a serious political strategy to deal with the dysfunctional Iraqi government and make sure that if we defeat ISIS, it can never come back. And only then should we consider putting American lives at risk.
You know, very briefly, though, Seth Moulton, while a lot of people who don't know very much about all this, I am included in that category, held out hope when Maliki was replaced. We just had the story the other day where the good news is the Iraqi government took back Tikrit from ISIS. That's the good news. The bad news is they have no ability to govern because of the same sectarian divisions that have existed since we invaded Iraq. So do you have hope that that political solution is anywhere in the offing, or is this just pipe dream stuff?
I think it's possible because I saw Iraqi politics start to come together at the end of the surge. But when Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus came back and testified before Congress, they were very clear. They said the surge has been a tremendous military success, but we've not made as much political progress as we need to make. So a lot of people called for a diplomatic surge. We, in fact, built the largest U.S. embassy in the world in Baghdad, but then we left it half full. So it was okay to withdraw the troops, but we needed to keep some advisors in the ministries and in the prime minister's office. And when we took those folks out, that's when the Iraqi government went off the rails, and that's ultimately what led to ISIS's invasion. You know, ISIS didn't just sweep in and defeat the Iraqi army. The Iraqi army put their weapons down and went home because they've lost faith in their government. So if we want a long-term solution to Iraq, we've got to ensure a stable Iraqi government. And you know what? If it's not us in there influencing what the Iraqi government does, it's going to be Iran. So I think we have we need to have a plan. We need to have a strategy. And it's only once we get to that point that we should really consider, you know, what the military piece of this effort should be.
Now, Congressman Seth Moulton, this is an awkward transition because we're moving from things that really, really matter to things that ultimately don't. But, of course, as you are well aware, the entire New England region has been transfixed all week with the travails of Tom Terrific, the quarterback, Tom Brady of the New England Patriots. So our question to you is, number one, is Tom guilty? And number two, what should the penalty be? If so, 4 games? I mean, really?
Well, look, I mean, I haven't read the report.
Shame on you, Seth Moulton. Go ahead.
But I mean, Tom Brady's never lied to us. I don't see why he would lie to us now.
Oh, good. I'm glad you said that.
Look, I mean, he's a great quarterback. We didn't need to play the football to win those games. I think the Attorney General made the point that this penalty is far harsher than a lot of people get penalized for criminal offense. And so I don't know if the penalty is just, but my hope is that we can just move on from this. The Patriots are a fantastic team. Tom is an incredible quarterback, and I look forward to a bright future.
I love that Seth Moulton is saying we and all these things.
That's right.
It is great. Hey, Congressman, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time. We'll talk to you again soon.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Congressman. Congressman Moulton represents the 6th District of Massachusetts. He was recently elected the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Health and Technology on the House Small Business Committee. Congressman, thank you again for joining us. Coming up, it's Law and Order with Sheriff, or former Sheriff, I should say, of Suffolk County, Andrea Cabral. She joins us next for Open Mic. Stay tuned for that in 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.